From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Mean Girls fans, get your burn books ready and take notes. The movie about the cutthroat social hierarchy of an American high school is now a Broadway musical and is nominated for 12 Tony Awards, which is so fetch. Among the nominees is Gray Henson. Gray grew up in Macon and plays Damien in the show. Gray, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, congratulations on the Tony Award nomination.
Thank you so much.
So where were you when you found out you were nominated?
I was in my bedroom in my apartment in Manhattan, and I woken up that morning. They do like a live stream of the announcements, and I was going to completely not watch and sort of just go about my day, but I couldn't help myself. Mm-hmm. And I was excited to see how much attention the show would get, you know, just beyond my own category. And so, yeah, I was in bed and I was just sort of watching on my own. And then I got just an onslaught of text messages and phone calls and emails from almost everyone I've ever spoken to.
Well, not in your category necessarily, but you are among some pretty illustrious company. Denzel Washington, Amy Schumer, Andrew Garfield. Your family in Macon must be so proud.
Yes, they are. They're beyond excited. My mom was an actress herself, sort of in the community theater. And so she's sort of living this out with me, I guess you could say.
Mean Girls was a super popular movie from 2004, written by Tina Fey. Let's hear a bit from the original movie. The main character here, Katie, is first meeting the Plastics at her new high school.
Okay, you should just know that we don't do this a lot, so this is like a really huge deal.
We want to invite you to have lunch with us every day for the rest of the week.
Oh, it's okay.
Coolness. So we'll see you tomorrow.
On Wednesdays, we wear pink.
There are so many memorable lines from that movie. I'm thinking, you will get chlamydia and die. Or it's like, yeah. I have ESPN or something. Why yep. do you think that movie and now the Broadway show still has such a strong fan base?
Well, I think, well, first of all, it's sort of the first time we all fell in love with Tina Fey's voice. Her comedic voice is so specific and so smart and so relatable.
Katie, I know that having a boyfriend may seem like the most important thing in the world right now, but you don't have to dumb yourself down to get guys to like you.
How would you know?
I know. How would I know, right? I'm divorced. I'm broke from getting divorced. The only guy that ever calls my house is Randy from Chase Visa.
And you know why?
Because I'm a pusher. I push people.
I also think high school itself is such a universal sort of experience. And even though we've all, you know, graduated and moved on, I think that situation we sort of find ourselves in over and over again, no matter where we are, who we are, you find cliques, and then there's a bully and there's a mean girl and then there's the underdogs. You know, it's a never ending vicious cycle. So people relate to it. And then, you know, people love Broadway. So when you adapt something that has such a cult following for the stage, we're lucky enough to have an already built in fan base.
And Tina Fey did adapt this book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, for film. And she is also wrote the book for the Broadway musical. Here she is talking about it recently with David Letterman.
Going into Broadway, we're thinking about, okay, we have what they've been calling a bifurcated audience, right? So we're trying to figure out how to make the show so that people who like the movie and want that experience are satisfied, but also that if you bring your dad or whoever and he's never seen the movie, that he also enjoys the story and has a good time. And I feel like it's going well.
Yeah, what are you hearing from people who, you know, were staunch fans of the movie? And, you know, people don't always take kindly to adaptations.
Right. I think the coolest thing that we've heard is that people love this on its own, separately. They love the movie, and then this sort of feels like its own thing, which is what's been really so special to all of us. Because from day one, Tina didn't want us to do, an impersonation of what they do in the movie, because what's the point of that? Just like play the movie if you're going to do that. So she really let us reinvent these roles and bring the show into 2018, because as you know, like, social media has sort of taken over the entire high school world and mm-hmm. hierarchy. So, it's really cool. I always ask people, I'm like, oh, have you seen the movie? And everyone just laughs at me. So I've stopped asking the question, because if you're coming to the show, odds are you've seen the movie. But I like to think that people that have no knowledge of the movie prior are still going to enjoy themselves.
When did you first see it?
Oh, gosh, I can't even remember the exact date. I feel like I was always watching it, you know? My friend group and I came out, I think when I was in eighth grade, maybe. It was, I felt like it was written for us, you know? It was so funny and so smart and so quick. And it was just always a part of our vocabulary and our vernacular. Like, it's something, the quoting in the movie was, it's sort of my generation's, like, you know, Heathers or what else came before, you know, movies like that. So,
like the John Hughes movies, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. And of course, like not Breakfast at Tiffany's, but
The Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club. Yeah. 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 And 16 Candles in that vein, you know.
Well, Damien is North Shore Highs. That's where it takes place. The resident gay best friend. There's a funny quote in the movie that he's almost too gay to function.
Right.
So what did this feel like for you? How did you move beyond that? That sort of gay best friend typecasting?
Yeah. So when I was cast, I think for me, the biggest challenge was to make Damien not a stereotype, because I'm openly gay now, but I wasn't out of the closet in high school. So I didn't really know what that was like to navigate the halls being openly gay. But I know for sure that for me, my sexuality doesn't define all of me by any means. It's something I'm very proud of and open about, but there's so much more to me than just, you know, being the sassy gay best friend. So I wanted to make sure that Damien was human before he was gay, you know? And so it's so well written, and I'm trying to bring a lot of myself to the role, but it of course has its challenges. But the thing that I think people relate to with Damien is that he's just so unapologetically himself, and he's so confident and comfortable. And yeah, he's an art freak and he's an outcast and he loves drama and acting. And but it's that's what I admire about him myself.
Yeah, so you were not openly gay as a teen, and you grew up in the Bible Belt, you know, you grew up in Georgia.
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
You were not Damien in high school.
Well, the thing is, though, it's funny, because I really was. I just didn't have the label, or I didn't own the fact that I was gay. I think I grew up in a really welcoming, a warm household that was totally let me be myself. My parents put me in ballet class when I was 3, and I was always performing, and I was always very comfortable in my own skin. It was just the label that I was afraid of, I think. So I was Damien without, like, screaming it from the rafters, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit of you at work with your co-stars on stage.
My mama used to tell me, baby girl, don't ever eat lunch on the John.
Your mother called you baby girl?
Singing, ha ha ha. So what if all the ducklings think you're ugly? It's because they've never seen a swan. It takes all kinds of people who need people, so find people you can bear. We'll find your group, your herd, your flock. Come take a walk and answer my small questionnaire, which I'll sing to you.
Gray Henson is with me. He grew up in Macon, and he's nominated for a Tony Award for playing Damien in the new Broadway musical, Mean Girls. Well, tell me about that, growing up in Macon. You said your mom was an actress, and I guess that's a really strong theater culture there. So had you not grown up in Macon, would you have taken another path, do you think?
Who knows? I mean, if I was born with the same mother, absolutely not. You know, she was the one that encouraged me to do all of it. And, I think it's what I was born to do. I've always performed, and I was lucky to be in Macon because, there's a huge community theater community there, and a dance community, arts community. It really is where I found my love for performing. I did summer camps there. You know, I acted in plays, and I thought I was going to be a dancer until I had this huge growth spurt and became a linebacker in size.
I wondered about that. You're a big guy.
I know. Yeah. I'm like 6'3". Yeah. 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 It's just, you know, I wasn't always this tall and, big, I guess you could say. But it's something as I grew into it, it's never something I thought about until I became a professional actor, because when you become a professional actor, you have to think about how you look. You know, you're marketing yourself. I'm the product. And so you have to think how you look in order to see how people see you and where that you fit in a show, a play or whatnot. But I found that the thing that's brought me most success is sort of owning my uniqueness and my weirdness, and not weirdness, but what makes me completely myself and different from everyone else. And that's how I found Damien. And before this, I played Elder McKinley in the Book of Mormon for 4 years. And so, yeah, I've been lucky. But growing up in Georgia, I had an amazing time. You know, I think people sometimes have horror stories about growing up in the South and feeling picked on and bullied and like an outcast. And I definitely wasn't like a lot of the people I went to high school with. But I like to think that I was still celebrated in a way, which was great. And I owe a lot of that to my parents.
Well, let's hear a little bit of you on stage.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. You might be thinking it's late, we should go. And they ran out of chips.
No, no, no! I can't even watch when she touches his hair. And I watched a snake eat a cow. Regina needs to be toppled. Sorry, Gretchen, I swear.
So, Gray, you were not bullied or picked on in Macon for growing up being into dance and theater. But is there just a little bit of sense of revenge swaggering around back in Macon with a Tony nomination in your back pocket?
oh, gosh, no. You know, it's just so funny. I mean, like I said, I wasn't like super, super close with my class growing up. But, you know, I was just doing my own thing. I always had plans to leave and to move on. And I think a common theme when you grow up in Georgia is to, you know, marry your high school sweetheart, go to a college nearby so you're near your family. There's an amazing, lovely sense of family and tradition in Georgia, and I love that. And I wouldn't change anything about growing up in the South, but I always knew that I would not stay there, and I wouldn't. You know, eventually you have to sort of spread your wings, and especially if I wanted to perform and be on Broadway and to eventually get nominated for a Tony, there's no way I could have stayed. But no, it's funny. A lot of people I did go to high school have reached out, and I love hearing from them.
This is not your first time on Broadway. You mentioned you had a leading role in the Book of Mormon. Not everybody understands how rigorous that is, performing in Broadway shows night after night, twice on the weekends, in matinees. Can you give us a little bit of insight into what your day is like?
Yes, it's athletic for sure. I'm playing a 17-year-old, which I'm definitely not anymore. And I'm dancing a lot in the show, and I'm running around. I feel like a chicken with my head cut off. And so it's definitely a workout every night. And you have to keep yourself, you know, healthy. So I try to get a lot of sleep as much as I can. And I don't have much of a social life right now, but maybe once the Tonys are over, I will.
Well, best of luck. And thank you so much for speaking with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That was Tony nominee Gray Henson. He grew up in Macon and plays Damien in the new Mean Girls musical on Broadway. We'll find out if he wins the Tony on June 10th. Just ahead, how one singer-songwriter from Atlanta turned to music to recover from a stroke. But first, what it's like to be young, Black, and Muslim in America. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Muslims across the world are in the middle of the month-long observation of Ramadan. Two young women are confronting some misconceptions about the experience of being Muslim in America. Ikhlas Salim is based in Atlanta and Mecca Ali in Washington, D.C. Together, they host the podcast Identity Politics. Ikhlas joined On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen in our studio in Atlanta, and Mecca joined us from Chicago on Skype.
Assalamu alaikum, Ikhlas and Makkah, and Ramadan Mubarak.
Wa alaikum salam.
Ramadan Kareem.
So this is what I really need to know. I grew up in Libya, and most people said Ramadan Mubarak. And then I came here, and people say Ramadan Kareem. So which one's correct? I'm going to ask Ikhlas that.
Yeah, so we actually just talked about this on our last episode of Identity Politics. And we started the conversation and we're like, Ramadan Mubarak, Ramadan Kareem. The source of it is we haven't figured out when that transition happened. So when we were growing up as kids, people said Ramadan Mubarak. And at some point, I remember in high school, people started to say Ramadan Kareem. All that to say, I don't know the source, but we recently asked our listeners the same question. So hopefully we'll have an answer for you soon.
But both of them are correct.
Yes,
generally.
Both of them.
Correct.
Yeah. So Mecca, how did you and Ikhlas meet?
So Ikhlas and I actually met in college, which is embarrassing given the fact that we grew up in the same city. We both come from similar types of communities, Black and Muslim, that are very grounded in the mosques and the schools and the religious institutions. But we didn't meet until I was a first year at Wellesley College, and Ikhlas came to visit. And so I took her around to my classes. We got to know each other, and we had a little matchmaking that occurred between an imam at her mosque and my dad that said, you know, you guys should look out for each other at this school. And so that's really where we got to know each other, and where we became close friends was in the college environment. And we've been friends ever since.
And Ikhlas, at what point did you realize that the two of you can start a podcast? At what point did that happen?
Yeah, so I started the podcast back in 2016, and I had floated the idea to Mecca and my now husband, and they both were just like, do it, just start it. And so I started the podcast, and the first person to interview was my mom. And I wanted to start it because I felt like I was looking in the media and there wasn't an accurate representation of the Muslims that I knew. I didn't see Black Muslim women. I didn't see people that look like my mom, like my brother. And so I wanted to create a platform where I could share these stories, and that were more true, I think, to the experience of Muslims in America. And then I think by episode 4, I asked Mecca to join me on this journey of identity politics, and she became my co-host and producer, and we've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, and it sounds fabulous. Mecca, tell me about some of the conversations that people can hear on this podcast.
Absolutely. So our community is one of the most diverse faith communities in this country. And people say that the American Muslim community is also one of the most diverse Muslim communities in the world. And so our podcast is really about showcasing that diversity and the nuances of what it's like to be Muslim at this particular moment at the intersection of a number of identities, whether you're a convert, whether you're white, whether you're Latino, whether you're from the LGBTQ community. These intersections really shape and complicate the idea of what it means to be Muslim, as well as the issues that are important to us. As Ikhlas said, we weren't seeing a lot of representations of us, but we also weren't seeing a lot of conversation framed by us. We were constantly being asked to react to things. And I think there's a danger when a community starts to view itself only through the lens of an external entity. And so we wanted to sort of turn the gaze inward and focus on the how it feels to be Muslim, how we experience Islam, and how we experience life in this multifaceted, complex ways. And so we engage in conversations on all of those different topics. Our tagline is that it's a podcast on race, gender, and Muslims in America, but we have talked to white converts about how being Muslim has complicated their understanding of whiteness and their and how people perceive them racially. We've talked to descendants of enslaved Africans about how going back to Africa was somewhat of a religious tour, a religious heritage tour, as well as a blood lineage tour. We have talked about just different aspects of our faith that we don't always understand, and when you're asked to be a representative of the community, you're supposed to have the answers, right? But mm-hmm. on our show, we're also asking questions and trying to explore what are these things, these values, these beliefs, these systems actually mean to us, and how do we live out these values, not just, okay, here are the talking points that we've all agreed upon as to why these things are important. So that's just a taste of some of the conversations that we try to have in a very public way.
Well, Mecca, I did speak to Ikhlas about this earlier. A lot of people say or view as Muslim women being suppressed. What are your thoughts? What's your take on that?
Sure. So I think that that's an interesting question, because I think I would love to see an example of a society where women are completely and totally uplifted. I think that Muslim women in particular have been under a certain type of scrutiny that I do believe is based in just a misperception of what Islam is. And it furthers kind of an agenda that makes it seem like the challenges that we face are somewhat foreign or separate from the sexism and misogyny that exists in the larger society. So I think that there are culturally specific ways in which sexism manifests itself within the Muslim community, just as it does in other faith traditions. friends in other countries and other parts of the world. But I think that people tend to fixate on the specific ways in which they manifest themselves in the Muslim spaces while not as deeply interrogating the really difficult and challenging experiences that women across the border are facing. And I think if you look at even the national conversation we're having about sexual assault, sexual harassment, equal pay, you name it, women are trying to lead the charge and being taken more seriously and kind of pushing back against what the impacts of patriarchy for generations have been.
Iklas, let's talk about some of the other issues that's affecting the community. Black Muslims are at times not accepted by other Muslims in other communities. Is that the same in America?
Yes, I think that racism within this country in general is something that has always existed and something that we still struggle with, right? And so when you go out in public, when you go to job interviews, right, Black people are treated differently and paid differently than our white counterparts. And so naturally you'll see this manifest within Muslim communities, right? The racism that exists is not absent within any type of religious community. And so, yes, I think in the Muslim community that we've had several guests talking about entering a mosque space where they did not feel welcomed, where they did not feel like they belonged there. And this happens in South Asian mosque, Arab mosque. And so something that we try to do on the show is really bring this to light. And so we had Marguerite Hill of the Muslim Anti-Racist Collaborative come on and talk about the racism that exists within Muslim communities. And a lot of the times our guests will say, well, how do we do this? How does this happen? How does this change? And Muslim ARC, they have very tangible means of making this change within their communities. So they lead initiatives around the country and trainings where you can really tangle with these issues. Because a lot of people talk about it, right?
Yes. Like, what are the initiatives? Yeah, like, what are we doing
not really
to change
about
this?
It. Yeah. Yes, and yeah. Something that Mecca always says that I think is just so key is just like, who else is your Black friend? For Mecca and I, with a lot of Muslims, like, will be their only Black friend, their only Black Muslim friend. And it's just like, at the very minuscule level, are you developing friendships with people who don't look like you, right? And so, yeah, I think that is something that we're constantly trying to navigate of how do we make our communities anti-racist communities, yeah, work with these issues.
Wearing a hijab. Have you had any negative experiences, Mecca, or have you heard of people who have hijabs on saying, you know, these are my experiences?
I think, yes, of course. You know, we all are aware of the political climate that we exist in and how that people who are visibly different, who are visibly Muslim, are targeted in a unique way, which is gendered because a lot of Muslim men are able to, quote unquote, pass in larger society, whereas women who do choose to cover their hair are marked in a different way. But I think that part of the reason why I cover is that my Muslim identity is inextricably linked to who I am, just as my race, my gender, all the different things that make up who I am are part of me. And so I can't erase my Blackness, right? When the going gets tough, I can't just present myself differently in the world. It's how I show up. And so part of why I choose to be visibly Muslim is because I also want to show up that way. Even in the face of hardship or different misperceptions about what that might mean, I think it's part of who I am and I'm proud of it. And if that means I'm opened up to a different type of conversation, then so be it, because I would rather people know who is in the room and who they are in conversation with than make assumptions about who I am.
Well, I'm speaking to Iklas Salim and Mecca Ali, creators of podcast series called Identity Politics. Iklas, do you find that experience is varied or different throughout the country? Like, you know, certain parts, maybe there are more Muslims, so people don't react like that. In the South, is it more difficult? What are your thoughts on that?
So in Atlanta, I grew up in East Atlanta, and I went to an Islamic school K through 12. My experiences are going to be a lot different. And so when I went to college up in Boston, for the first time, people were like, oh, there Black Muslims exist. Can you tell me more about that? Are you part of the Nation of Islam? I've had people ask me if I'm Arab. Like, mm-hmm. You know, people were looking for a source of how could it come to be that you, a Black American, can be Muslim? And so that narrative, I've realized, hasn't spread throughout the country. For a lot of people, when they meet me, it's their first encounter. And so I try to give a little bit of back history to how I came to be in this country, which is pretty ironic because Black people are native to this country and have been Muslim for hundreds of years. So, yeah.
Right. So that curiosity that people have around you, do you take that as a positive thing or do you just think that just opens up a conversation?
Yeah, Mek and I were recently talking about this, actually, and I'm someone who I try to be incredibly patient when people ask questions, although the question has to be sincere, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to welcome a space of negativity. But if you're out of genuine curiosity, I'm more than happy to answer those questions. And the podcast has been really awesome because usually when someone asks me a question, I can be like, we talked about that in episode 23.
Right.
You should go and listen. We had this very conversation. So the podcast has been really great for answering people's questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will just add that, you know, I think Ikhlas is great and her patience that she's able to exude. I think I am very similar in that if people are approaching me out of curiosity, I'm willing to engage with those conversations. But I do think it is a dangerous game to play where you have to justify your humanity to people that are asking you to prove that you're fully human, that you are fully moral, that your values are compatible with just general good values and norms. And so those are the things that I tend to be more sensitive to if I feel like the question are based in assumption that I am somehow less than or less ethical or less moral because of the religious tradition that I follow. I think that for me, that is a tremendous waste of time and that those types of questioners have to do a lot more internal work and self-education before they'll be ready to engage authentically and sincerely with my difference. And so that's something that I try to navigate very carefully.
And Ikhlas, was there a point in your life where you decided, well, this is the way I would like to dress? Did you have to come to that point?
Yeah, I think I'm at that point right now. It took me a long time. I am someone who like dresses for the season, for the trends, like every fall, summer, spring. You know, I had a new look that I was going for. And I had this moment where I just was like, am I choosing or am I letting someone choose for me? So when we think about modesty, or I guess the opposite of that is immodest clothing. But when you go into stores, you're presented an option, right? And you're not, you have to choose from the options. And right now I find myself going to less malls and really just thinking critically about like how Mecca was saying, how do I want to present myself to the world? What feels comfortable to me? And the way I'm dressing now, I guess, would be in the category of modest fashion. But really, I'm going for what feels comfortable, what feels right. How do I want to present myself? And what spaces do I want to enter? And so even today, I was thinking, do I want to wear heels? Because I'm going to Jummah at the mosque and I have a graduation later. And I'm like, no, I don't want to wear heels. They're right. Not comfortable. But that's what we consider to be dressed up for women. And so just really rethinking all of these assumptions, which I may be years late to, but, you know, I'm 29. I'm still learning and growing. So I feel like I'm here now.
Yeah. How do you think America or Americans view Muslims?
Yeah, I think America is tricky, right? I think right now, especially just politically, we're in a time where people are really noticing the other America, right? And that is something that I feel like I've always known to be true. If you grew up in a Black family, the other America is not a surprise to you. So I think, right, there are always going to be people who view any type of group that is different from them as wrong, right? Not aligned with their values. And so I think that there certainly are people in America who feel like Muslims don't belong in this country. But I can't say that that's all that exists, right? Mm-hmm. I walk into my work, I walk into the gym, I walk into all of these spaces, the grocery store every day where I feel welcomed. I feel like I belong here and not that I need that validation. I know I belong here. But there are certainly various communities that are creating these spaces and doing the work to acknowledge Muslims in this country along with other groups that are marginalized in all different types of ways. So I think we're really seeing a sort of solidarity in this country as well.
Absolutely. I just wanted to pick up on that very briefly, because one of the images that really comes to mind when I think of this political moment that we're in is after the first Muslim ban was brought down, the image of Muslims praying in airport and their allies sort of locking arms around them and protecting their ability to do that. And so there's always backlash, and then there's the backlash against the backlash. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we are in this really incredible moment where when we talk about diversity and inclusion, which are such hot topics, people are finally understanding that Muslims are part of the fabric of this country. They are part of that definition of diversity. We should be thinking about how we include them, and that Muslims have been in this country, you know, prior to even its founding. So I find tremendous hope in the moment that we're in. I think that the challenges that present themselves are challenges that we've seen before for previous communities. And I think that there are lots of great organizations and people that are doing good work to ensure that we continue into progress in a way that's truly positive.
All right. So Mecca Ali and Ikhlas Salim, thank you so much for a great conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Great. Thanks, guys. Take care.
That's On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen speaking to Ikhlas Salim and Mecca Ali. They are co-hosts and co-creators of the podcast Identity Politics. We posted a link to the podcast at gpbnews.org.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here in the South, barbecue means different things to different people. Consider the debate over vinegar or tomato-based sauce. That will go on forever. But the game has changed with Atlanta's growing immigrant population. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about the history of barbecue and go into the kitchen with the chef of Chama Gaúcha. That's a Brazilian restaurant in Atlanta. What is your favorite barbecue restaurant in Georgia? You can call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk and let us know, and be ready to defend your choice. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. After a lot of good years writing and recording music, Atlanta-based musician Angie Aparo's life took a sharp turn in April of 2016. He suffered a spontaneous carotid artery dissection. That's a rare form of stroke that left him unable to communicate and with a critical memory lapse. Now, 2 years after the potentially crippling incident, he's back performing in local venues in and around Atlanta and is here to talk with us about his long road to recovery. Angie Aparo, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Angie, you woke up on that day feeling some nausea, terrible, terrible headache. Apparently, this was a tear in your carotid artery. Did you know that you were having a stroke?
Well, there's no way to know that your carotid is torn or dissected, but you do get apparently massive headaches. I've had crazy headaches, but these were like a whole other crazy level. And so I thought my neck was out or something. So I was going to the chiropractor, and I guess what happens is, I thank God I pulled into the parking lot. I had the stroke in the parking lot. But I guess with a dissection, what I'm kind of learned is that your body's sort of trying to heal itself. So it essentially is like a clot is sort of forming, and that sort of went to my brain because there was no really cholesterol or plaque in my arteries and all that. So it just creates this big, massive kind of tear, and then there's stuff floating around now in your brain. So that's what I understand is what happened. So I pull up to the chiropractor, and I just felt really weird. And stuff looked weird. The colors looked weird out in the sky. And I had the car running, and I was like early. The last thing I remember is I opened the door, and then it was just two things happened. The headache went away, and I was just like kind of like you don't know what's happening. You just are losing all your ideas and thoughts. And the radio went off, which I guess they say you lose your hearing it for a moment. And then I was kind of, oh, man, now something's going on. And then I kind of froze up and got paralyzed a little bit and went on for a while. And then it just went away. And all of a sudden, when it went away, I was like, oh, my God, I knew immediately. So then I just looked at the chiropractor's office, and I kind of, now I was sort of walking drunk and stumbling. And I got in there, and the crazy part is that it's a chiropractor that I never go to. She was just there that day, and she had a stroke a few years ago, and she knew exactly what was going on. I live on Hilton Head, and I was in a hospital within 20 minutes. I mean, that's what probably saved a lot of damage.
Wow, so pretty freaky experience from the sounds of it. And what's the prognosis for this? Were you going to, you know, the potential of losing some cognitive ability?
Mine was mostly in vocabulary, is sort of the best to recover from. Of course, I had no idea, you know, I was in the middle of writing a record. I had a rock opera I was working on. I had a TV show maybe coming out with Tim McGraw, and I was like, "This, you're not giving me, this isn't good news. It's just going to be." I'm like, "Oh my God, I can't even talk to you, and I can't even write," you know. And but that the stroke, once they settled it down and got all my meds figured out, and you have to, I think, get past a certain window, 30 or 40 days, and then your percentages go down more. But the dissection is, it's still my problem. It's still the problem now. They couldn't operate on it. So that there's sort of these two entities that were, two things that were going on. So kind of was learning, relearning stuff, music stuff and words. And then now they're just watching this because they don't want to, it's kind of dangerous wherever it tore. So that's sort of what I'm dealing with here. And then the mental comeback was kind of, it was crazy. It was a very, my neurologist said, he knew I was a songwriter and a singer. And he said, you know, I said, man, however I was talking to him, I said, I gotta do this now. I got a record coming out. You know, I was just kind of mad. And, he said, well, I said, I want to be in therapy every day. He's like, there's no, it's impossible. You don't have the money.
There's no real treatment for it?
Insurance is going to pay for it. You know, every day is like maybe two a week. It's just, he's like, that's not going to happen. And I said, well, you got to, he told me, it was amazing. And I know this is what saved me. I guess the subtype of aphasia that I had, I don't know what the name is, but it's sort of like, I can look at my phone, and I know what it is, but I can't tell you.
Mm-hmm. So you couldn't find the word.
Can't find the word.
Oh, for a songwriter and a singer, that's...
So I could write, you know, the dog ran down the street in my head, and I couldn't say it to you. So he said, music, well, you need to go sing everything you see in the world. And I was like, what the hell is this guy talking about? And he said, I just go to a grocery store, anywhere there's a lot of items, and just when you see something and you know the name and you think you can say it, sing it. So it'd be like, there's a ketchup, just anything stupid. But he said, we teach, you know, kids A, B, C, D, E, F, G, D. It's all this attachment to melody and word is very quick. And so he said, I did it for months. And he said, it will reprogram, your brain will sort of find another little spot and start another little library.
Well, you got a little bit more sophisticated on your new record.
Yeah.
Then there's the ketchup in the aisle. The latest album is called Life as a Flower, Life as a Gun. Now, this was released in February. Let's listen to a clip. This is from a song called Church Bells Versus the Television from the album.
Read my note from today.
Church Bells Versus the Television. Church Bells Versus the Television.
Church Bells Versus the Television.
So in that song, as with a number of songs, we hear you talking to Siri on the phone and her responding. I mean, why did you include this?
When I was still trying to come back and I just couldn't, I would write something down and I just couldn't remember it. And I was like, how am I going to, you know, make a record? I can make a record. I can stumble through that. But how am I going to play these things live? You know, I just still was under this idea that I would never get it back. And my neurologist was like, it's going to come back. But I just didn't want to wait. And I was just trying to make the record probably earlier than I should have. So I came back to my studio, which is just in my bedroom, and I started going. It just wasn't working. And so I had a friend, a rapper friend of mine that is amazing, and I thought maybe I'll make a rap, you know, sing record, like, you know, folk kind of rap singer record, and he can rap the verses, and I can remember enough for, you know, that kind of thing. So I met with him, and I just, it was just, I couldn't work with people. It was just too difficult to be in a, it was so much in my head going on, and I couldn't really... Interaction wasn't great, and I don't know if I can produce something with someone else with me. It just became too much. So I, when I thought about it a little longer, so I got back to the thing, and I had remembered before the stroke. I always write my lyrics on my phone usually, and this is when I was fine. I had remembered being at the mic with my guitar, and I'm sitting there, and I'm going to sing this part of the song, and I can't remember it. So I used to always say, you know, Siri, read me the note from today, whatever. And she'd go back and I'd look at my lyrics and I'd sing and be fine. Well, I did it one time and the mic was on and I heard me asking her and I heard her come back and I remember doing it and I went back and found it and it was parts of like in Church Bells, but she wasn't being used there. And I was like, what if Siri is my rapper? And that's how it started. I was like, well, then I'm going to make a record with me and Siri. And so it took about a couple months to make that song because I was very slow, you know, 3 months, 3 hours, and I'd go to sleep for, you know, a day, whatever. I was tired, very tiring. And then I told Susan Bennett, the original Siri voice, I talked with her on the phone about this, and it was weird. It was bizarre that part of that therapy was me interacting with her. And she said she hears that. She gets a lot of people, brain injury people, that would say that their interaction with Siri, it's a therapist. You know, so she would say, I was really recording her for the record, but I'm looking at it going, I can hear her talking it back to me. Yeah, so I'm talking my words or typing them. I was able to type then, like what the lyrics are, and I'm just trying to get her to say them so I can actually record her on the mic. And it did. It was like literally by the second month, I used her for one other song a little bit, and by the third song, I was able to do it on my own.
Well, it sounds like you're sort of crawling back, but still on this record, on the new album, there's a lot of personal tragedy there. There's the stroke that you're talking about and singing about, your divorce, your third divorce, a lot of vulnerability. And I know before this record, you had suffered some depression, and I wonder if, you know, you think that depression and getting to the other side of that, did that help you, give you capacity to get through this?
I mean, I think everything is a lesson. So that definitely creates some kind of strength, you know, to have not, you know, gone off the edge when you're younger and, you know, whatever, commit suicide or anything. I guarantee, yeah, definitely. It's really just, do you have purpose? I mean, a lot of it goes back to that, just to me. It's like one of my grandmothers lived to 105. The other one just died at 104. I mean, they're immigrant, you know, that came from that whole world. But there's just I don't know if it was just like the artist kind of just wants to be heard or something. I don't know what it is. But no, I agree that the one of the songs on the record is about Sylvia Plath, is about the depression kind of stuff. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you obviously get stronger, you know, anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
How long was it before you actually did pick up a guitar again?
The guitar I had no mobility problems. The guitar, it was all I'll tell you what's crazy about the guitar, which you don't realize how crazy the brain is. And I was like, I knew where all the fingers went for a G, but I looked at the letter G and I didn't know what G was.
Hmm.
It was that kind of thing.
So like, it was like a body, physical memory, but no visual memory.
Yeah, you're like, you're going, you know, we as your guitar player, you go, a G looks like this. Well, it has a meaning, but it had no meaning to me. So it was easy. I just went online and looked up a G chart and, you know, oh, that's the G. Oh, that's the, so that came back like within a week or two. But then it was like, you know, a lot of it was, I couldn't, the carotid was on my left side where my hand is for the guitar. There was a lot of pain in this that I was having to, had to be, yeah, because it keeps tearing. The problem with the dissection is it keeps tearing. So I had, that was a window of about 8 months where I had to really do nothing to tear this. They didn't want me like coughing or, you know, like it got really gross. So the guitar itself came back pretty quickly.
Your first big break, really, in the music industry was after you wrote this song, Cry. I mean, you made a record.
Right, right.
Clive Davis, I think.
Yeah.
You heard you in his office and gave you a record contract back in the day when that kind of thing happened,
yeah,
I guess.
When there were record deals.
And then Faith Hill later recorded this song, Cry, on an album. She won a Grammy in 2003 for Best Female Country Vocal Performance. Let's hear just a little bit of that.
Yeah, could you cry?
Now, I'm interested in the lyrics here because from what I understand, she actually changed a line of your song. Let's hear the difference between those two songs, Cry the Angie Aparo version and the Faith Hill version. Give it up, baby. Whimper would be fine. Some kind of clue that you're doing time. Give it up, baby. I hear you're doing fine. Nothing's gonna save me. And I see it in your eyes. Some kind of heart. So Angie, is that something that you've done before? You know, change something to fit a particular singer?
Yeah, I mean, if that was the first song I've ever had covered by anyone, so you know, being a singer to me, it's sort of like you're casting a character. I don't look at it like rewriting my song. I look at it like I'm just writing a version for her character.
I'm wondering, when you play now, do survivors of stroke, people who have had brain injuries, do they come up and speak to you? Do they relate to that?
A little bit, but not too much. I do get, what's weird is, I guess it's the whole thing of like any kind of survival, it sort of ignites. I get a lot from just things that have happened to other people that aren't strokes, that are survived a heart attack. It's just sort of the survival realm. So I that does come up, because I guess the artist, if they're open enough, your story has to be, you know, the story has to be told.
Angie Aparo is a stroke survivor who taught himself to play guitar and to sing again. He's currently on tour for his latest album. It's called Life is a Flower, Life is a Gun. He's going to be playing June 8th at the Mad Life Stage and Studios in Woodstock. And here's a clip of Angie playing Memphis City Rain in our studio in Midtown Atlanta.
I am a song. I've been here all along. Be here when the hatred is gone. Hey, can you recognize me? 'Cause I'm the light of the sun. And if you come with me, and if you let it be, sing my melody, yeah.
Angie Aparo played a couple of songs for us when he stopped by, and you can see video at gpbnews.org. That's our show for today. As always, we want to hear from you. Angie talked with us about using music to recover from a stroke. Have you ever had to relearn a skill? Give us a call at 404-500-9457, 404-500-9457. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, The Raven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is executive producer. And our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.
For the world, a long time waiting here. For the world, a long time waiting. For the hatred now to be fading. For the love to give, yeah, the love to give, yeah.